welcome to Broken English First-Hand Immigration Stories. My name is Andrew Mahar, and I am the host of this new 6 p.m. to 7:45 slot. Just a little background for people tuning in for the first time. This is a show where I bring in people who have immigrated here to the United States, specifically Chicago, and I get their story of showing up here and what it was like to assimilate and learn the culture and the language and just overcome anything that comes up, because everyone's story is different. As we go through here, if you're listening and you're saying, hey, I am an immigrant and I want to tell my story, please feel free to contact me through BrokenEnglishPodcast@gmail.com or on Facebook or Twitter through Broken English Pod. As you hear, I said podcast. This used to be a podcast. Now it's a live radio show. Q4 has been incredibly helpful and incredibly nice and have allowed me to come and broadcast this live to get to more people because they also believe these stories are important. So I cannot thank them enough for allowing me to come and do this. And if you get a chance to come and support one of their live shows here, Q4 Radio is the best. They have we are doing this live, and I'm recording them and releasing them as a podcast the week following. So if you miss an episode or you want to tune in, you can always go and follow the show on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, the whole deal. If you just search Broken English, you will come across it. We are gaining momentum, and I appreciate everyone who sticks around and listens. But my guest of today and my only guest is a friend of mine, Graciela. She is from Venezuela, and I met her about 5.5, almost 6 years ago. She was kind enough to take me in when I didn't have a place to stay as a total stranger on my first week of living here in Chicago, and she is great and kept me from dying here. So that was the best. And she has been a great person and an incredibly open-minded voice to immigrants from what I've talked to her over the years. So I appreciate her stepping in. Graciela.
Hey.
How are things?
Great. Yeah, thanks for that introduction.
Yeah, not a problem. I didn't even think that I was going to mention about the time you saved my life. I moved here when my entire apartment situation fell through, and I was staying out in a motel out in the suburbs of Chicago, and a friend of a friend introduced me to Graciela, and I was lucky enough to, her and her boyfriend at the time let me stay at their house, and it was thankfully the best situation I could ask for. So yeah, once again, yeah, 6 years later, I'm here and I made it, and now I'm on, live radio, and you're here. This is great. So I drank a lot of coffee today. I'm getting all revved up here. This is awesome. So let's start from the beginning. Where in Venezuela are you from?
I'm from Caracas, the capital city.
Okay, awesome. And you were born in Venezuela?
Yep, I was born in Venezuela.
When did you end up moving to the United States?
In 2010, January to be exact. So it's very easy for me to like follow how many years I've been here.
Oh,
I've been here 9 years and 4 months.
Wow, that's awesome. I'm glad that worked out. That's great. So when you were growing up in Venezuela, so Caracas is an enormous city at this point. Were you like right in the city, or were you like suburbs, outskirts, or?
We were right in the city. It's actually a big city, and I would say we weren't in like the downtown area, not the suburbs either, but like up in the mountains. If you think of Caracas, for instance, Caracas is kind of like a valley where there's a lot of like different areas where people live in the middle, and then it's surrounded by very, very tall mountains. So you can also have a lot of residences like going up towards the mountains.
Really?
So, yeah.
That's awesome. So like if you're standing in the middle of the city, you can like see mountain ranges in each direction?
Absolutely. 100%. And in fact, wow. it's crazy because it's been such a long time. And sometimes when I go back to visit and I look up to see the mountains, I'm amazed. It's such a thing that you don't really think about. You don't think about the weather when you're there. You don't think about the nature that you're surrounded by. It's kind of taken for granted.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you come to Chicago in January.
Yeah.
And you regret every decision you ever made up until that point.
100%.
That is awesome. So, man, that's great. So as far as like your family goes, did you grow up, with both your parents? You were in, what do your parents do?
So my dad, his background is in electrical engineering, but he shifted his career to be in finance over the years.
Oh, nice.
But because of that, I growing up, I always thought of myself as, you know, an engineer. I always wanted to follow my dad's footsteps. So my brother and I went to engineering school in college there. And my mom, she started her career in business. Then she had us and kind of like stepped away from college and became a full-time mom. But afterwards, around, I want to say, by the time that I was like around 10 years old or so, she started a business, a wholesale business distributing records across the city.
What, yeah. like music records?
Music records, yeah.
So really?
It was, yeah. As a kid, that was a huge benefit because I would like go into her stores and be like, okay, I want these 10 records. Can I take them home? And then she'd be like, yeah, take whatever you want.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so that was really helpful. That was like my way of like expanding my knowledge into music is because of her.
Wow. Okay, so and how old were you when she started this record distribution system?
I think it was about 10 years old. That's where I remember, you know, kind of going back to school and showing my friends like, hey guys, I just have this new record. Let's check it out. And it was a cool thing to share among friends.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a very formidable time for music anyway. So to show up and like, okay, so when you were 10, so vinyl records at that point, did she sell like CDs and tapes too or just vinyl?
No, mainly actually, I should say CDs. That was okay. The main thing.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Cause I was thinking, I was like, if I showed up in fifth grade with a vinyl record, everyone would be like, where does that go? What do I do with this? Okay.
And it's not like today where actually people appreciate vinyls again.
Right. Yeah. It took a long time for them to come back and realize that it's time to, yeah, it makes you get up off the couch. If you got to stand up and flip it over every 22 minutes, it keeps you active. I like vinyl for that reason and that reason only. No, cool. So growing up, and what was this is pretty vague, what was it like growing up in Venezuela? Now, so if you're saying that you're in the city, I mean, similar to Chicago, you had to have, I mean, a relative amount of crime rate, a different amount, like describe a little bit about the city if you have any, I don't rattle off statistics, but anything you got.
Yeah, so for me it was pretty interesting because as I was young, I didn't consider our city to be dangerous. Safety was not an issue. I remember it shifting drastically as the political environment changed as well. And then it became a topic, right? It became part of our conversations almost every day. Whoever you're with around family and whatnot, talking about, well, you know, this area over here is not safe anymore, so make sure you're careful while driving over there. Or now having somewhat of a curfew, right? So you can't stay out late at night as much anymore, or be careful on which parks you go to. And that sort of shifting for me when I was about 12 years old. And it's interesting because I was able to remember still having a childhood where everything felt like free and fun, and I was able to enjoy my time with friends. And then all of a sudden, it slowly started shifting, and I saw the impact more when I was getting towards high school. But it just gradually intensified that insecurity and that feel that you're restricted and you can't really live a free life anymore. That really affected me more than a lot of my friends at the time.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, I can't imagine. I honestly have no idea what that would feel like other than, I mean, no, I can't. I don't even know why I said that. But so growing up, I mean, did you know what was happening politically? I mean, and I know very little. Like, I don't want to say enough to comment on like, oh, well, socialism's good, socialism's bad. Like, I get there's a level of corruption and everything, but like, did you as a kid, like, did your parents talk about it? Was it like politics tied with crime, or was it just like, oh, don't go there?
Yeah, it was definitely politics tied with crime. And to us, it really shifted when Chavez came into the picture. Whether you're part of the opposition or not, I mean, I don't think anybody can deny, like, the environment changed. Things really changed. And, yeah, without getting too much into the details about, you know, what kind of discussions we had as a family or around friends, it started creating the separation. I mean, you would see just families come apart, friends come apart, it so drastically because of their belief system and how they felt, you know, whether right or wrong, how they felt about the political environment. And so with that, of course, the whole scene just becomes much more hostile and it's more aggressive. And that led to more crime as well. That and the fact that, well, we started to see a lot of shortages in basic needs, right? Like when you go to the supermarket today, right, you can find toilet paper, milk, sugar, flour. These are basic things. And all of a sudden, these weren't available anymore to us.
So the shelves were like, they were empty?
Yeah, in a lot of areas they were. Or, you know, it was just simply known, like, you cannot find toilet paper anymore. And then the interesting thing about this is that these black markets start coming up where people find toilet paper and you have to pay more to get these things.
Oh.
And that was the thing. And actually, you know, then you have people that own a business of this type that, it, you know, has access to all of these things and make a profit to make it available for people at a higher price.
Wow.
It is ridiculous.
So literally down the street, you could have a higher price grocery store that has everything the old grocery store used to have.
And not even a grocery store, because it's very hidden. So you just knew a guy's name, and then that contact will provide like whatever you need. But it was never a formal business.
Wow.
But it's so big, which is very interesting, because something like that, I can't imagine it happening here. Maybe there's something like that I'm not aware of, but it's not a formal business, yet very, very big, where everybody's aware of it and everybody actually accesses that type of business.
You're actually talking about drugs. That's actually, yeah. We do have one here. It's called the drug trade throughout most of the United States.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That is wild. So did your family need to contact these people for toilet paper? Like, what did you, like, yeah. You, like, so just regular Joe guys had to go out and find these, like, kind of back channel connections to get basic needs?
Absolutely. That's what it turned like. And the way that this came to surface is because you regulate the prices. The government started regulating prices for specific products, telling, for instance, the manufacturers, you cannot sell this product above this price range.
Okay.
And that price range or that limit that they would establish would be lower than the cost for that manufacturer to produce the product.
Oh.
Which, you know, it makes no sense.
Bad for business.
Exactly. Yeah. You put them out of business. So a lot of these manufacturer companies would have to basically cease producing that product or shift whatever they were making to something else because this product was now regulated.
Wow. And so what was the cap on the product? Like, what was the extent of it? Like, so was it just common needs, or was it like also bags of chips were, like, was it just like things you need to get by through your day, or was it like also like kind of other things?
That's a good point. I never thought about it that way, but it was more about the basic needs.
Okay.
Not so much like, chips or, well, although Coke became restricted, like, you know,
really?
Coca-Cola.
Yeah. Yeah, that's outrageous because most of it's made in South America.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Wow. So, man, so they locked down the commodities, and then so the people who were selling the commodities just stopped selling it because there's no point in losing money. Wow. And so when you, man, So how did that start? Like, when you, there was just one day where you just went into the store. Like, I can't get over the fact that there would be empty shelves. Sorry, I'm just trying to picture, because ours are just so chock full of, I mean, half of it's garbage, half of it's like actual food that you need. So it's hard for me to picture the fact that there wouldn't be anything in there. But man, so you're now just regular people having to go through these back channels to get toilet paper and milk and things that you can no longer find on the shelves. If you didn't know one of those guys, you just had to go out and find it, or like what?
I think it was more of a word of mouth thing. Mm-hmm. You would just have to talk to a friend of a friend and figure out how to get those things.
Sure.
I can't imagine, like, for people that couldn't afford those higher prices, I mean, a lot of them would just not even have access to them. So,
right, so that actually hurts them.
Of course. Because
if the store stops, so if the poorer side, which is supposed to be helping the poorer people, stops carrying those things at the reduced price because they can't handle it, and then they have to pay double down the street. I get it now. No, I don't get the whole problem, but that is crazy.
I'm forgetting an important point too, though, actually. Of course, from all of this, the government's or the president's objective is to also somehow gain popularity from most of the population, right? So when you implement this type of regulation, but you still want to satisfy the masses, what do you do? Now you're in control of these products, right? You can now give them to whoever you want it to and become a hero.
Mm.
So that was their strategy for a very long time, is have trucks filled with these products going into, I don't even know what the right term is in English, but are you familiar with the term favelas?
No, I'm not. But I.
So they use that a lot, like in Brazil, for instance. But it's like these houses, like these very poor houses where people don't have a lot of resources, and they would just show up with all these products and be like, "Hey, the government is just giving this to you because we know you need them for free." And at that point, of course, you gain their votes. You gain, their support.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because, I mean, how could you not? How could you not look at them as almost like a god figure at that point? If you've got kids to feed, your whole life you were told to have kids, and then they take away your food, and now you've got a bunch of these kids that get, wow. Yeah, well, I mean, that's how you trick them, for sure. That's how you convince them that the whole thing's a good idea. Man.
Yeah.
Wow. So do you think that was their plan the whole time? Or do you think they realized that they had under... Because there's no way that anyone with any mind of brainstem is like, we're going to make toilet paper 8 cents a roll, but it takes 20 cents to make it, and like to not see that coming. So you think they saw that coming?
Yeah. I believe it's a strategy. I mean, everybody has their opinions, of course, but the fact of the matter is that that was not the only thing. You know, they also regulated information. So a lot of like the media... any kind of channels, they started shutting down these different network companies, and to the point that there would be only one channel, and the only information that would be provided in that network would be coming from the government. So whatever they wanted to distribute, whatever information they wanted to share, it would come from them. So what do you call that, right? I mean...
Yeah, just straight propaganda.
Exactly. Yeah. That's when... You know, conversations started happening about like, oh, we're turning into Cuba right now.
Right. Yeah. Because, I mean, at that point, you are. You're just a bigger Cuba.
Exactly.
And yeah. Weren't they like, didn't they all know it? Didn't like Castro and Chavez? Oh. Like, they were, I don't know, like, their ties. I don't know the time frame. It could be totally two different time frames, but I mean, they were
like best friends.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you
would
see.
What a weird friend. What a weird friend. He just sits you down and is like, I'm going to teach you how to become famous in your country and take over the whole thing.
No joke. I mean, they spend a lot of time together in Cuba and whatnot. But yeah, that's what we started seeing, that as we started growing up, and, you know, things just started getting worse and worse over time.
Interesting. So as you get through this time now, how that was from the time that you were like 12-ish, let's just say like young teen, through the time that you came to the U.S., it was people were getting these like back channel goods. Did it ever go back to things on the shelves?
Not really. I mean, every now and then you would find products on the shelves and everybody would just go running towards the store, right?
Oh, wow.
And then some products became available at one time, but then they would, like, cease to exist again. And it was just kind of like a cycle, more or less. And then nowadays, I mean, really, it's even after moving out of Venezuela, it's kind of really surprising and shocking, right? Because when you're living in that environment, you become used to this. And I've talked about this to a lot of people. You think that there's a limit to the things that can happen until you've had enough. But when you're conditioned in that environment, that limit starts shifting. And you start thinking to yourself, oh, things are not that bad. It could be worse. I can manage.
Yeah.
And then because it's such a gradual change, you see your life changing and your mindset changing as well with it, and considering certain things as normal. But if I were to tell you these things, you would think this is crazy. This is not normal, right?
Yeah.
And so after leaving the country and being now used to my lifestyle here and going back, the shock is tremendous. I mean, we were talking about basic needs before around food or toilet paper or whatnot. But now it's like medicines, and it's been like that for years. These are primal needs. We need them in hospitals. We need them for people that have severe diseases, and we can't help them. A lot of people are dying simply because they cannot have access to medicines.
That's outrageous.
Yeah. And so like we saw that, I saw that exponentially, that issue exponentially growing after I left in 2010. And it's pretty sad. It has not gotten any better ever since when I was 12 years old.
Wow. That has been so. And how old are you now?
I'm 32.
Wow. That's a long run. Mm-hmm. It's 20 years of sneaking toilet paper out the back of a warehouse. Wow. That's crazy. I mean, because at any point, if you ever saw someone walking down the street with one of these commodities, you know that they just got it somewhere. You know, like that's how does the government not find those people? If they're like, how do they not stop those back channels from making sure everyone is affected by this? Anyways, I'm going too far into that part. That really messed me up. But the medicine, I just couldn't even imagine that. Yeah, because I mean, and you know it's curable because 20 years ago or 21 years ago, you could get that cure at the hospital before they regulated the whole thing.
Absolutely. And wow. And being here and knowing that your family is back home, that some of your close friends are still back home and living through that, is one of the most difficult things to do, because you feel helpless. You feel like, you know, you should be doing more. And there's a little bit of a guilt sentiment. It becomes very hard. It becomes hard to know, like, you know, what you should be doing to support better.
Right. Would you just ship them things? I mean, like at this point, it would be just supplying them supplies.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. And trying to figure out like how you can help others that are perhaps looking to migrate to other countries, giving them advice, like this is what I did, if that's what they want to do. Of course, you know, there's some people that are still willing to stay there and they're trying to figure out like what they can best do for their careers and how to support their families and in their future. But for others, I've helped a ton of people that have this idea of, you know, leaving the country, and it's such a hard move, especially for people like us, where we're so tied to our roots and our traditions and our family there. They will ask you anytime, like, you know, how did you do it? Like, how did you get through this specific hurdle? And even the adaptation part of it is important. How do you go into a completely new culture and adapt to that new environment and still be okay?
Yeah. And that whole, I didn't even think about having to be here and like not just considering yourself lucky to be here, but also all of your family. I mean, because both your parents still live there, right?
Actually, no. In the recent years, they moved too. So I have my dad in Spain. My mom is in Florida.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. My sister in London and my brother in New York.
Wow. So they just gave up on Venezuela, huh?
Well, yeah. And more recently, I was the first one to leave from my family. Everybody thought I was probably a little bit crazy back then.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's, so what was that feeling like when you were like, when did you decide to come to the U.S.? How old were you when you even thought about that?
So that's an interesting, I got to give a little bit of background to explain that too. When we were young, when I was 5 years old, we lived in Oklahoma. So, that was like a little break in our childhood, I guess, where we were not living in Venezuela. So from 5 to 7 years old for me, we lived in Oklahoma because my dad was doing a master's degree.
Oh, okay.
So at the time, I'm the oldest one of my siblings. So for me, I was able to have big memories of that time. I have a really good recollection of what it was like to live there. If you ask people nowadays as an adult, like, what's their idea, what's the perception of Oklahoma, they can say whatever. But for a kid, it meant a very safe environment. There were very kind people to us. And, you know, kind of like to the point that we were just talking about, going to a store and finding everything that you need to and having all these options. I mean, people don't think about that here. You have so many options, and that's just about, you know, if we talk about like markets, right? But think about careers. You can be here anything that you want to be, and it's doable for anybody. Like, nobody has an excuse really to not accomplish something here. That is not the same case back home. There's a lot of limitations, and it's much, much harder for you to become whatever you want to do, right? And so anyway, from having that experience, my mom would always say this, like, she would call me like the little American of the family.
As like an insult or like as a, like, oh, get over here, you little American. Like, you'd be like, I want Cheetos. And she's like, you little American.
Not as an insult or anything like that, but she would just smile. And what it meant was that after that moment, after living in Oklahoma, I started having these tendencies that, let's say, for instance, my preference for music or my preference for TV shows. Mm. It was all geared towards American music. And here we can talk about, let's say, rock at the time, like punk. And, you know, this is like what I was into. Which was actually very heavily influenced by my uncle as well. Like, we listened to ska music together, and
nice. You didn't strike me as a ska fan.
Oh, it was another time back in the day.
No, be proud of your roots. This is all part of the story.
The funny thing though is, like, if you put ska on right now, I will start jumping because within me. I love it.
That's why you can't listen to it now, exactly. Because you're an adult and you can't be constantly kicking your feet around like a
Exactly.
It's how it goes.
But yeah, so as I grew older, that was always a thing. I wanted to be more involved in that type of culture. And we do get a lot of influence from America, actually, into Venezuela. But I saw the differences very clearly between me and my friends and me and my brother and sister, for instance, what we were into or whatnot. And as I came into my teenage years, that just intensified. And I wanted it all. You know what I mean? When I looked into my future, and I've always been the type that really thinks into things and just kind of, I can be standing for hours just looking at the horizon and just trying to think of life and people and what makes us us. And so a lot of these thoughts were about, what do I want to do in my future? Like, what does that look like for me? What does happiness mean to me? And for some reason, all the signs to me pointed to, you know, being here. I wanted to come back here. And also, through our teenage years, we visited Florida a lot. So I remained in contact with, you know, this type of environment. Mm. Despite the fact that, you know, every state over here is completely different than the other. But to me, it felt like, oh, I'm in touch with the American culture. Right?
Sure, yeah.
And so, that was very clear to me, I think, when I started college. When I started college, that's when you know, you're now an adult, and you start thinking more and more about the future and what you're going to do, family perhaps, even though I didn't necessarily want to have kids right away. But I thought of my life like 10 years down the road and what that would look like. And I did not think that staying in Venezuela was an option for me, even when it wasn't at its worst. So after graduating college, so I did engineering school back home. And I want to say a month after I graduated, that's when I moved to Chicago and to pursue a dream. At least I didn't know at the time if I was going to stay here for the long run, but I had to live it. I had to experience what it was like to be once again here and live my life here, and kind of challenge myself to be in an environment that's not one that I felt comfortable with my whole life, that I grew up with.
Wow. That's incredible. Yeah. So when did you learn English? Because your command of the language is better than mine. So I just want everyone to know that you have almost zero accent unless you want to. And that that's okay.
Yes.
So when did you learn to speak English?
So my mom would always be next to us to teach us English. But I want to say that period of time where I lived in Oklahoma, that's where I was really able to absorb the language. And what's interesting to me, because I don't think a lot of people think about what's the ideal age to learn a language.
Mm-hmm.
We all know that as kids, you can easily absorb a new language and, you know, your brain is just kind of a sponge. But what are the best years, right? And I see the differences between how I learned English versus my siblings. I was here in Oklahoma from 5 to 7 years old, and I was the one to better absorb the pronunciation of it all, and just I felt more comfortable with English in general. My brother was here from 4 to 6, so just a year younger, not that much of a difference, but he struggled a little bit more. Nowadays he does great, he has an excellent vocabulary, but as we were younger, it wasn't as easy for him as it was for me, and then even less for my sister. My sister's 3 years younger than me. So I think there's definitely that range, maybe after 4 years old, that's kind of the perfect range to really teach a kid a new language. And so that helped me kind of start it off. And then school just helps you expand your vocabulary. But I don't know if you remember. Well, no, I met you 5 years ago. When I first moved to Chicago, I was extremely shy. I was such an introvert, and it was a struggle. It was such a struggle because I knew that despite the fact that I had the pronunciation, I didn't have the vocabulary to feel like I could express myself, like my personality.
Sure, right, because you're limited to what you know.
Yeah,
you're just I mean, if you know 200 words, that's all you've got.
Yeah, well, and not only that, but in school, they teach you this technical language. They don't teach you the slang, and you know that you're just going to sound off with the words that you've been taught. Slang is so important to be a reflection of your personality. And in thinking about that, my result was just don't talk at all. Because if I can't be myself, I'd rather not say a word.
Gotcha. So you were kind of like hiding in plain sight to avoid kind of not being able to. Yeah, wow. That's interesting. So you come here, so you leave the month after you graduate. Did you have a job lined up? What was your plan because you had to apply for a visa, right?
Yes, that's
right. What was that like? Like when you had actually, because I've had different guests who either came here illegally and worked their way through the process or came here through a visa and overstayed and then worked their way through it or whatever. What was it like to do the whole thing?
It was actually kind of difficult. I mean, none of these processes are easy, really. You have to provide a lot of documentation and proof, and it takes several months to get through it. But I was towards my last year in college when I decided I wanted to study culinary arts. So big shift there from engineering to culinary arts, but just something that I had to do.
Sure.
And at the time, I remember thinking, I always knew I had to come to a big city. I would never go to a small city just because of my lifestyle there and what I'm used to. And at the time, I was considering Chicago or New York. And I visited both cities back in 2008 for the first time. and went to New York first. And I'm like, this is it. This is a place where I have to live. This is incredible. Like, there's so much going on. And it's such a, New York is just so alive at all times. And I wanted to feed off of that energy. And so I almost had made my decision. And then I visited Chicago after. And I was like, ah, wait a minute.
This is the stuff. Yeah. No, I feel you. I grew up in upstate New York, and I went to the city a couple of times throughout my life there and throughout. And it's busy. It's cool. It's captivating. Like, it's impossible to not, like, wow. You know, whether you're impressed with it negatively or positively, it impresses you either way. And then Chicago, I remember the same thing. I came here, and I was like, this is awesome. We were walking through, like, Lakeview. My friend brought me up here to show me. We, like, happened to be walking through, and it's like, I didn't realize it was, like, the yuppiest part of town at the time. And I was just looking around, like, all the fences and all these houses are all tucked into each other, and it's like, people are nice. They're all waving to each other and stuff. And I was like, yeah, this is it. This is where I want to be. Right. Yeah, that's all. Okay, so I thought that was just me. I'm glad someone else also went to New York City. He was like, whoa, okay, pretty cool. And yeah. Then realized Chicago is even cooler.
Yeah. Well, it just seemed more livable, if that's the right term.
Totally. Yeah, it's less dirty.
Yeah.
Considering, I mean, it's still pretty dirty, but it's not New York. We at least get to hide our trash.
At least, right? We at least have alleys.
Yeah.
Nothing against New York City, guys, but...
Most of our listeners are in Chicago. So we'll go ahead and say, yeah, whatever, New York. It's fine. Come here and tell us to our face that you're not as that you're better.
Yeah. So, but yeah, Chicago, like, seeing it for the first time, I just immediately fell in love. And so I applied to school here. And then basically started my visa application process and whatnot. You have to go through paperwork indicating, like, sponsorship, for instance, like, or providing an affidavit, like, proving that you have the means to support yourself while you're studying and things of that nature. And, yeah, that process, I think it took us, like, about 6 months or so. I worked with the school at the time back and forth. There's usually a person assigned for international students, so they do help out with a lot of the process.
And then, that was in college or in culinary school?
I was in college back home, talking to a representative here in Chicago, helping me, guiding me through that process so I could attend school here.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so, yeah, after all the paperwork, next thing you know, like, everything was approved, and I was getting ready to move, and... That was a big shift. It was really hard for my family and even for me. But I had at the time I had just such it was such an exciting opportunity.
Yeah.
So all I could see is just immense possibilities. Like, the world was my oyster, you know? And
yeah, well, because at that point you're like, what, like 22?
What? Hold on. I think it was 22 or 23. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're not 23 and you think that you're about to take on everything, then you're doing it wrong. Every 23-year-old is the most confident person I've ever met, and for no good reason.
That's
kind of when you met me, and I was ungodly confident for no reason.
That's so
And then
funny.
I came here and fell on my face.
Yeah.
That's like you come in so, like, certain of the future, and then bam, you're whatever. Yeah. That's awesome. No, so that's
the same thing happened to me, actually. And it's such a humbling experience. That's when you actually go through the struggle. That's when you actually learn, when you grow up. And that happened to me as soon as I landed here.
And so you just, how did you get all your things here? Like, the actual physical moving process, was it like a bag? Did you have, like, a shipping thing? Like, how do you get enough to live from another country all in one shot?
I actually just packed two big suitcases. And I knew I was going to come home 6 months later to a year later or whatever. And so I could pick up more clothes. But, I mean, living over there. Oh, and this is a good point to mention, too. So in Venezuela, you really live with your parents up until the point that you're getting married. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. So a lot of people here go to college. And, you know, that's when they go to college, that's the first time that they live alone. But for me, I was still living under, you know, my parents' roof. And so I didn't have anything with me. I didn't have furniture or anything like that. I just left everything behind. And
right, what are you going to do? Take your mom's sofa?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, mom, I'm going to ship this sofa. So yeah, I just packed my suitcases pretty much, moved to Chicago, and then slowly started buying furniture. You know, that I lived in a very small studio, so I didn't need much. Probably got everything from IKEA, I think, even. But yeah, you slowly just start. I guess like the focus at the time was, you know, let's just make sure that we feel comfortable like where we are, instead of like having to like build up your lifestyle right away. Plus at the time, there was also the possibility for me to go back. Who knows? Like I was thinking, well, maybe I'll study here and then I'll go back. I don't know. So for the time being, and I think that happens to a lot of people when they go to a new country, is don't invest right away. Don't spend like all your money and this and that and making your life super comfortable, because you never know. You just want to see how the environment feels, see if that's where you actually want to be long term, and then, you know, if you're comfortable, then great. But in the meantime, it's just you go with like, you know, your the bare minimum.
Sure. Well, that makes sense, especially if you don't know. You've only visited one time and like you saw the city, like this is cool, but to throw all of your life into it is pretty Yeah, that's pretty intense.
Exactly.
Wow. So you fill up two suitcases full of clothes. You come here, you get an apartment. Did you find an apartment? How did the apartment search go? Because I did all my stuff on Craigslist, and I was in the U.S., and it was a disaster.
Yeah.
How did you do it from another country?
So that's interesting. I had a period of time, the first 4 months I moved to Chicago, I had a boyfriend at the time. He was studying in Western Michigan. And we had a long distance relationship for the last year before I moved to Chicago. And we had kind of agreed on like, okay, I'm going to go to school in Chicago. He got a job in Chicago. So he was here by the time that I was moving. And so I moved in with him. So we went from long distance to now living with a person. And of course, that's a huge shock, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And for that reason, I think that's when you really get to know someone too. So it lasted just 4 months, us living together. But that time was enough for me to get an idea of the different areas in Chicago and where I wanted to go, and find a place that's close to school and things like that. So I moved to Lincoln Park, to a little tiny studio, just very close to the lake, but actually Clark and Wrightwood.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Nice. So, that's a nice little spot.
It's nice, yeah. And it's a good place to start, because to your point, like people are very friendly. You can just walk anywhere. And yeah, it felt comfortable. And also, I think being part of a tiny studio was so key, because it made me feel like I didn't need much. I was happy in that tiny space, making it my own, like making it a little bit artistic and whatnot. And I had so much fun with that. I think, and that maybe that's another topic, but I think like as we grow older and we start acquiring like bigger spaces, more things, we just somehow feel like we need more, like we're lacking things. Mm. So for me, being in that small space, made me feel like I just had everything I needed, and I really didn't need to pursue for a lot more for the time being.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I feel like sometimes with studios, you end up propelling yourself out into the world because you don't want to stay in that little room for too long. Or it's just like you just, I mean.
Oh, I loved it.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I loved it. I would blast up the music and then start dancing in my little studio. It was my little nook. The funny thing is I would even invite people over. I used to have like sometimes 10 people over in this little studio.
You are describing being the worst neighbor. Like, just crack it down, blasting music, inviting friends over.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Don't worry. I won't. We don't open up the phone lines till later. If anyone live next to Graciela and is listening to this, please don't tweet at me. I won't read them to her.
Oh, man.
So you fell in love with your apartment. You came here. It didn't go so great with this guy. Yeah, I couldn't. I have lived with two people in my life, two relationships. The first one did not work out. The second one, I'm going to marry the woman, so that's cool.
Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I'm very excited for you.
Thank you very much. It's been great. But yeah, so it worked out for that. But like, to not know. And I also got kind of pushed into the first one as well. It was kind of, and then all of a sudden you're just like, oh, you put your toothbrush there?
Yeah.
Why? You know, and everything's just like, why do you do that? And then all of a sudden you're just miserable. So, right. So at this point you're not like great with the language, but you're getting better. You're kind of in a weird spot with this guy. You're here in a city. You started a new school. Did you cook before this?
Yeah, I would actually plan a lot of dinners throughout college back home, basic stuff. And the funny thing is, I thought that that was cooking, but all I would do would just throw chicken in a pan and then like 10 seasonings on top. That's not cooking.
Well, it's not culinary cooking. It's not like high end. Yeah. That's fair. I would call it cooking. You know what I mean?
Right.
But once you've been through 3 years or 2 years or whatever the long school is, yeah, that's nothing compared to what you probably learned later on.
Yeah, exactly. So it was good to learn like the technicalities of like let's call it chefing, right?
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
So you come here and you start the school and like. What was it like to have to sit and immerse like 100% English? Like, because I mean, at that point, even if you knew some of the language, it's like that. Like when we learned Spanish in school, I learned Spanish.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So then all of a sudden you show up and it's just slang for days, especially in the cooking world. I mean, I don't know if chefs and cooks are as rough in school as they are out in the world, but the ones that I've worked with are. You learn some stuff. I was an American who was learning things from cooks when I worked in the restaurant industry. So that was it just jarring? What was that feeling like?
It was terrifying, honestly. It was terrifying because of the fact that, you know, I wanted to fit in. I felt like, you know, I was this foreigner, right? So, and for a long time I had been struggling with that concept. Feeling foreign to a place, feeling like you don't belong. And that's one of the most difficult things to overcome. And I wasn't even, you know, I actually had a like pretty decent scenario. I'm sure like for other people, they struggle much more. But for instance, like one of the key people in my life was Brian, my ex. Like I met him right the first week I was here in culinary school, and before we even started dating, I think it was like a whole year where we were friends, and he was the kindest person. And you know Brian, like he just has this personality where he loves to help people no
loves
matter
it.
What and,
yeah.
And people love him for that, and he never has anything, also he doesn't expect anything back from people.
That's the part I didn't believe when I started to meet Brian. But the guy in the beginning of the episode, I mentioned that she saved my life. She was with Brian at the time. Yeah, he helped me for no reason. You guys took me out for a beer for 20 minutes, paid for my beer because I didn't have any money, and then he let me stay on your couch for a week.
Yeah, that describes him. He may not even have money to pay for his own beer, but he'll give it to you anyway. Like,
sure.
You know what I mean? And so that's how he was for me. And he noticed right away that I was struggling to adapt, that I was struggling to, you know, just show my personality. So he took a lot of time just to show me the slangs, in some ways, in a very funny way. But yeah, he helped me feel more comfortable with the environment. And just for instance, one example that I remember is coming to our first party. In culinary school, and you can imagine going from engineering where everybody's so technical and professional to culinary school where everybody's an artist, and you know, you can find any kind of person in there. And I was not used to that, but I knew deep down that I had to be open-minded, and that's all I care about, like just be open-minded and adapt, and then you can figure it out. But going into this first party, first thing I see when they open the door is a huge bong on the coffee table. And I'm thinking to myself, this is okay. Like, weed is totally normal in America. And I had never been exposed to it before.
Is it not in Venezuela? Or do you just not, is it like a black market? Like,
it is in Venezuela, but I really grew up in a little bubble, you know? So it wasn't as common. Maybe now as adults it may be, but yeah, I was exposed to it for the first time to that magnitude, and I was like, what is this, right? But I've never been the type to judge, and I didn't want to form an impression right away of like that environment. I just wanted to immerse myself in it and then, you know, see how it goes.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, yeah, yeah, don't freak out. Just calm down.
They're intimidating. Seeing a giant bong on a table is without a doubt. Like, you walk in, you're like, whoa, okay. Because you immediately see the level. Yeah. You walk in, you don't know who you're going into. You don't know what you're talking about. And then all of a sudden, you're just like, oh, we're doing that. Yeah. Oh, you guys get really high. Not like, oh, yeah, I smoke weed to take the edge off. Sometimes I need to sleep. I got weird anxiety. It's like, no. I'm trying to forget who my parents are high. You know what I mean? Like, that is, yeah. So I could imagine being scared. I don't want to say I'd be frightened, but yeah, it's definitely like.
That's a good point.
We'll see how it goes.
I never thought about it that way. But even for someone here, yeah, even today where I'm now used to this environment, like, if I see a huge bong in somebody's house, I would be intimidated. So yeah.
You're afraid they're going to ask you to smoke out of it. That's my biggest thing. I'm like, you're not going to make me smoke weed out of that thing, are you?
Please.
Please, for the love of God, I have children.
Yeah. Well, actually, the interesting thing that I found through that party, and this goes on a little bit. So interestingly enough, like, everybody in culinary was so kind about and accepting to the fact that, for instance, I wouldn't partake. And they'd be like, oh, this is completely fine. No worries. Like, here's some food. Like, you know, help yourself. And that was very different than what I was used to in Venezuela when it came to drinking. Because if you didn't drink, oh, my God, everybody would be such a bully. Even through college, it'd be like, come on, you just have to have shots. It was intense. And so right away, I was like, oh, this is actually kind of nice. Like, everybody's just pretty accepting. But anyway, Pass the bong, I go towards the deck, and literally 10 minutes after, this guy shows up and he shows me some cocaine. And he's like, hey, do you want some? Just like, no big deal. This was, it didn't even occur to them that maybe I would be in shock. No. It was that kind of party where, like, hey, you just want some?
Sure, they brought it. Yeah, you're in culinary school. You do cocaine.
Exactly. That's, like, yeah. That's the thing, right?
It's weird that you don't have cocaine. Right. I was like.
Exactly. And so I'm like, at that point, I was kind of scared. And I'm like, oh, my God. So, all right. And I looked at him straight in the eye. I'm like, I'm good. Thank you, though. I even said thank you. Thank you for offering.
Thank you for your cocaine, sir.
Exactly.
I greatly appreciate you thinking of me. You can go ahead and do that all yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's startling for sure. That's jarring any way you slice it. I mean, still, as a 28-year-old man who's been around, every time I'm like, oh, nah, I'm good.
Well, and the other thing that people don't realize is that coke here is more of a thing. A lot more people do it than what I know back home. Or at least... with the people that was around, because, you know, you're next to Colombia. Venezuela's next to Colombia. So the grade of the cocaine that you get there, it has to be more intensified. It has to be more pure. So the cases that you know of people doing it and dying are huge.
Oh, yeah. So your image of cocaine is basically suicide.
Yeah, like a deadly drug. And so... and over here is like cut way more, so a lot more people probably do it because of that reason. Because sure. It's like, you know, you're just getting high for a day and, you know, chilling.
It's 90% baby aspirin.
Exactly.
The rest of it, and then it's 10% Colombian cocaine, and then, yeah.
Right. And so to me, it was like terrifying.
Oh, right. Because if you didn't see, did you know that American coke was like terrible?
No.
No. So you think these guys are just like almost going to die there.
Yeah.
So your idea of this party is like, people, you guys need to get some water in your system. You need to stop what you're doing right now.
Yeah. No, I literally, actually, that did come through my head. I thought, oh, somebody might die tonight. But okay, let's see what happens.
Sure. Luckily, it's so terrible here. It's all just stomped to nothing.
Yeah.
So.
And then the last thing that happened during that party is, like, somebody came to me with a huge, I mean, this massive bowl of what looked like, tea. It was tea. And it looked like a punch bowl. And a friend of a friend came over with like a really big ladle, and then goes, oh, here, try my tea. I just made it. And, you know, you're around culinary students, so you're thinking, oh, there's people in the kitchen actually cooking. And then there's this guy making this awesome tea. And I thought, okay, let me try his tea. And immediately Brian was there. Immediately Brian like took it away. And he's like, there's no way you're drinking that. And I'm like, what's wrong? And he's like, oh, we'll talk later. And it was a mushroom tea.
Oh, I knew it. Oh, no. You almost... That's so irresponsible of that person to give you a psychedelic without you knowing.
Yeah, it's disrespectful, for sure.
That is, that's not cool. That's not, like, offering. That's, like, literally forcing you, and kind of they knew they were tricking you.
Oh, 100%, yeah. And that's just, I mean, now, after being here so long, I think of that person, I'm like, that's not a good thing to do to anyone.
To anyone. Yeah, I wouldn't force that on anyone.
Absolutely.
Also, who has that much mushrooms? Who has so much mushrooms that you can make a pot of tea?
Right?
Out of a ladle, like,
well, that was
not that I know, Mom. I know you're listening to this. I don't know anything about this stuff. It's off of the Wikipedia I pulled up right now.
But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's the culinary world. That's what it was. That's when I realized, so this fairy tale idea of what becoming a chef is,
yeah,
it was like shut down at that moment. I'm like, this is the reality. The reality is right there. Like, these are the people that I'm going to be surrounded with, that I'm going to learn with. And I had to very quickly adjust, you know, my expectations if I wanted to continue.
Yeah, right. Because now you have to leave that and be like, well, I got to keep paying money to be around these people.
Yeah, right. But at the same time, you know, one of the key things that when I mentioned earlier, I moved in with my ex at the time. That was the first place I lived in when I moved to Chicago. I quickly saw the differences in perspectives that he and I had. And that was one of the key things that drove me away from him, was the fact that even under those circumstances of shock and a little bit of fear, right, I was still able to remain open-minded and enough to respect these people for whatever who they are, you know, respect their choices.
Right.
So I'm still going to be around them, and I have no reason to judge you for whatever you want to do, even though it's not something that I want to share. And they could probably have the same feeling towards me. So I've always been that kind of person. But he was not. He was so against it. Like, if you were even coming close to these things, he would just get upset. And he would be upset with the fact that I would surround myself with these people, even though they were my classmates.
Sure. Yeah.
And that was one of the things that, you know, I immediately noticed. I cannot be with someone that's so close-minded like that.
Sure.
But anyhow, yeah, that's, that piece, the language barrier, those were definitely struggles. And then moving on my own, despite the fact that I love my studio and being by myself, it wasn't as easy at first. It was coming to terms to the fact that, yeah, I was in a completely different place, and I had to figure out my own values. I recently was talking about this with some friends and basically explaining what it's like to grow up with a certain set of values, right, that are so, so different, that are instilled in you by your parents, by your school, your friends, and whatnot. And then when you're so far removed from that, and you're for the first time alone in a completely different environment, you have this exposure to the new culture, and you have to, for the first time, form your ideas, your perspectives of the world, your own. So think about that. Think about the fact that now you have to challenge the views that you grew up with. If you want to adapt, if you want to actually absorb the new culture and kind of immerse yourself in it and grow, because I think that's a key element. If you really want to grow in a different environment, you have to go through a practice of challenging your views, seeing if whatever you grew up with makes sense to you, because everybody, you know, is different. But does it really make sense to you and who you want to be? And from that, do you reject it or do you not? Do you accept it? And you know, you decide, like, even if you reject it, how do you want to expose yourself to those things in the future? And so that has, over the years, been a constant practice over and over again. And I think it's a little bit easier now. I'm to this point, after almost 10 years of being here, I know now who I am. But yeah, I'm sure also, like, we're all growing, and so that definition of who I am today, 5 years from now, may be different.
Sure.
But at that time, there was, like, a lot of these thoughts, and it was a struggle to think, like, even of the factor of happiness, right? What does happiness mean? When you're in an environment that you grew up in, you have all the same friends, your family around you, there's a safety net, right? And happiness becomes being around them. It becomes so comfortable. When you're removed from that, what does the happiness really mean? You know, is it becoming successful on my own, or is it like trying to find my network of close people that I can rely on again? Because I didn't have that for years.
Right.
So many years.
To start over again and have someone to always pick up the phone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I had multiple friends over the years, but none that I felt comfortable with sharing like my deep thoughts about. And, you know, that took a long time.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I would imagine. And living alone will do that to you for sure. I've lived with roommates and stuff through the whole time in Chicago, but like same thing. You learn a lot about yourself, especially when you're in the beginning. When you're like, I was broke in the beginning. Like, there's a lot of stuff Chicago just teaches you. And I was a totally different person before I moved here as well. And then you just kind of realize, you're like, oh, that was all totally outside influenced. All the people I was with, my friends, even my family growing up, there's like everyone told me what to think. And then all of a sudden you're that person. And like, now you get out on your own and you're stuck in an apartment alone. Being like, and you really, that's awesome. That's very introspective. I am glad that you brought that point up, because that would probably be probably be more of the toughest part of moving here, aside from the paperwork, is finding out who you want to be here.
Yes.
And then being it.
Absolutely.
And I mean, do you shape yourself out of the image of somebody else, or do you? Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. Well, I'm glad you could share that here.
You get it. Yeah, you get it.
Yeah, that's great. So you're here, you're learning to cook. At what point, now you go through school, what point do you not become a chef? Because you're an engineer, right? And we didn't mention that in the beginning, but you're an engineer still, correct?
That's in my background, but I'm not even applying that in my career.
Didn't even talk about that before the show. this is awkward. But yeah, so there was a time when you were an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
After culinary school.
Yes, that's correct. And so after I graduated from culinary school, I started, let me think about this real quick. Oh, I became a dog walker. Yeah.
Yeah, everyone. Yeah, everyone does. If you're in your 20s in Chicago, you walk a dog for money. That's just how that works.
Absolutely, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I realized after graduating and in working for 3 months at a great restaurant downtown, that was not for me. The lifestyle was insane, very hard hours, and oh my God, the people are so competitive, but to the point that is not healthy. They're trying to like kind of stab you in the back anytime they can for them to look better, you know, at the chef, right? So they can scale up faster. So it was a very hard environment, and I quickly decided that's not for me. So. I was a dog walker for 6 months, which was the best job I've ever had. Till this day, I'll say that. Sure, you don't make a lot of money doing that.
If you're not concerned with the money, hang out with dogs all day sounds pretty cool.
Exactly.
I've got one at home I'm missing currently. Yeah, no, I feel you.
Yeah, and it was incredible. So I did that, and then I took a sales position. And I knew that that's what I had to do in order to feel more comfortable with English as a language. So that was 2 years after living here, and I still feel pretty shy about talking to people and you know, just, I don't know, be who I really am, how I really feel. So I did sales. It was a business-to-business sales, and you come in contact with so many people. I mean, hundreds of people sometimes in one day. And that practice over time made me open up and feel more comfortable. So that was a great first transition before I went back to like my profession. And so I did that for like a year and a half or so. And then I moved to an engineering firm in the suburbs, and we did engineering sales. So I would size up different equipment for manufacturing companies, and it became much more technical. And a little bit more challenging because there's a factor of vocabulary. Now you have to expand it and you know, speak all these terms that you know in Spanish but now translating them into English.
Right. And they're oddly specific.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And if you say, like, literally something slightly off,
oh my God,
you could completely throw off what the people are buying or ordering. Yeah. Wow.
And the funny thing, like, I'll tell you, like, one funny story. You know, for instance, in engineering, we use the word gauge a lot because mm-hmm. gauges are everywhere in every equipment. So, but when you read that, you know, G-A-U-G-E, right? And you don't know, how would you say that?
How gouge? You called it a gouge?
I call it a gauge.
A gauge. Well, yeah. That's honestly, if you had to break down what you know of the English language, yeah, gauge.
Exactly. And so I would go into these meetings with the VPs and whatnot, would look at a project plan and be like, yeah, the gauge is right here, and be so confident about what I was saying. But I all of a sudden saw everybody in the room looking at each other like, what is she talking about? And then until one point, this happened for months, until one point I go back home and I asked Brian, I was like, hey, how do you say this word? He's like, gauge. I'm like, oh my God, I've been saying this for months and nobody would correct me.
No one had the heart to tell you that you were...
Seriously.
Are you insulted by that or is that a compliment? The fact that everyone, your coworkers, it's one thing to be a customer and be like, I know what she means. Clearly, that's a picture of a gauge. I know that this is like, you know, whatever. But like this is, but like your coworkers must have heard. Your boss must have heard.
Yeah. He knew I was saying it wrong, but he didn't have the guts to tell me.
Wow.
Jesus.
Yeah. Come on. Help someone out here.
Man, no.
If you're listening to this, ex-boss of Graciela, you did the wrong thing.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that everyone I'm referencing is listening to our show, even though it's 2 weeks old.
Who knows? Maybe one day.
You never know. I hope your boss, your ex-boss, eventually hears this, and then he's like, man, I should have done the right thing. And that's advice for anyone. If you work with immigrants and they're saying the wrong thing, I do that at work. I hire people who immigrated here, and I politely correct them because they don't want to do that.
Please do that. Yes. Man. Even if it's the slightest thing, because they will appreciate that.
Yeah, I bet I would need some serious assistance, I would imagine. So what is just so we don't go too far into the story here, what you got any other instances of saying like the wrong thing? You had mentioned that that saying like, you know, that you don't know all the slang or like it kind of got you confused. What do you have any specific instances you'd want to, other than the gauge thing?
So, yeah, there were a lot of funny stories. There's actually two things that I can remember from back from culinary school. Going back to the fact that I didn't understand slang and, you know, there's these terms that I just had no idea what they meant. So there was this one kid at school. He was always the one just throwing the jokes at you, but, you know, kind of like directly at you and making the whole room laugh. And so he would do that a lot with me because he knew I didn't have any comebacks. And this kid is like also extremely smart. So if he actually found someone that did have comebacks, he always had something back and back and back. And so one time we were walking down the hallway after class and he looks up at me. And he says something like, hey, Toots, what are you doing tonight? And I didn't even know what Toots meant. And I was like, what is he even saying? And I just kind of laughed, you know, in a shy way. And Brian was there next to me. And he leans over and he whispers, you know, tell this to him. Say that back. And I'm like, wait, what? What does that mean? And then he's like, just shout it out back at him, you know. And I go, hey, Mike. And I was like, he's like, yeah. And I was like, I've been practicing my Kegels. And then the entire hallway starts busting out laughing. And I had no idea what I was saying. And I look at Brian. He's kind of like hiding, but laughing too.
There's no way he's not. He knows. Oh, that's so great.
Yeah.
That's
no, so great. It was amazing. And then they told me, and I could do nothing but laugh, right?
Well, the words have been said. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
You exactly. Might as well just accept that you got caught right there. Yeah, they got you.
Yeah. And so, like, that was one of them. Like, yeah, I had
so
no
you
clue.
Learned Kegel the hard way.
The hard.
Okay, that's
yeah. And the other one was same kid, actually. So after after cooking and during a class, we would always clean up the kitchen together. So he's like just sweeping his way through, and same person, Brian comes over and he's like, "Hey, go tell Mike he has a nice camel toe." And I'm like, "What? What does that mean?" He's like, just say it." So I'm like, it's the same attitude, right? Like confidence, right? "Hey, Mike, what's up? You got a nice camel toe." And this kid looks up. And this is, again, the kid that always had something back to say at you. He looks up at me. He smiles. And he's like, "Gee, thanks." he had nothing to say back. He was just in shock that this like little Venezuelan was just telling him he has a nice camel toe. I'm like, oh my God.
Oh, that's awesome. So that's fun. I'm glad everyone could have fun at your expense.
Yeah, seriously. Well, it's still like one of the things that I laugh at, you know, nowadays, looking back at those times.
Yeah, and you've got to trust him. And Brian's a very trusting guy. I mean, he's helped you out in all these other ways. Why would he steer you wrong in this one?
Exactly,
and then you realize he steered you incredibly wrong. Yeah. Very wrong in that direction. But that's, oh God, that's great. So, oh boy. So that's fun. So now you are, you were selling engineered equipment, or like business-to-business equipment. Mm-hmm. So what are you doing now? What do you do for a living?
So after that, I moved to the company I'm working for now. It's a big data and tech company. And that shift was so hard, by the way, very hard to make, because it's actually, I think, very cultural. Back home, you know, an engineer can pretty much fit anywhere. It's not like you have to work for an engineering firm. But shifting industries in America is extremely hard, because recruiters and HR people, they just see that they have to have a one-to-one match. They don't look at the overall skills. So for me to go from an engineering firm to a tech firm, they're like, I don't know. Like, your background doesn't really work well here. Why would you as an engineer work here? And that happened for, I tried to apply for like multiple companies in the city because I was working in the suburbs. I applied for like hundreds of them and got denied because I was trying to shift industries. And so at the time, well, still my friend from the sales job, she was working in HR here, and she mentioned, you know, "I'm not the recruiter for this position, but I think you should apply for this position. You'd be a good fit." I interviewed with the recruiter over the phone, and after literally like 5 minutes, she goes, "Well, I don't think you would be a good fit, but yeah, nice chat," pretty much. Oh. And yeah. And we hung up the phone, and I was in my car when I took that phone interview, and I started crying. I literally broke, because it was so intense, like finding a job and the right job. It took me so long. I'm like, I don't know what else to do. And I told my friend, and she messaged me back. She goes, "Do not take no for an answer." She's like, "Message her back, tell her that you want to meet with the hiring manager, and that you just want the opportunity to talk to him over the phone. And that's it." And I was like, well, okay. But thinking there's no hope, right? But I insisted again. And she's like, "Well, you know, I can't promise anything, but sure, I'll forward your resume to the hiring manager." Next day, this guy's calling me back. He's like, "Oh my God, you need to come here. We have to talk to you face to face. Like, we'd love to meet you." And, you know, the rest is history. We met, and you know, it was a great conversation, and I loved my job afterwards. I could use a lot of the engineering skills in here, because it has to do with just process management and making improvements to things. And so they assigned me a ton of projects that needed improvements, that needed to have things fixed.
Sure, break them down, spread them out. Pile up the good parts, make
exactly.
it efficient.
Exactly.
It's literally the definition of engineering, I think.
Pretty much. Can do that anywhere.
You can do it anywhere. Yeah, so you just have to be able to get on the phone with someone.
Exactly.
That's the trick. Man, that's awesome. So so that's where we are currently. So you are helping the process systems, to the systems of, what does the company do?
It's so our company, kind of at a high level, we basically sell data or our technology. We have different platforms, technical platforms, for our clients to be able to see how their products sell across the U.S. We work in the CPG industry, so our typical clients are retailers, like, let's say, Kroger or, you know, any kind of retailer where they sell food or convenience stores and whatnot. They want to see how the product is moving in their stores so they can make adjustments and whatnot and deal with the manufacturer companies differently and make, the, you know, certain types of strategic decisions with them. And then the other type of clients that we have are the actual manufacturers, like, let's say, Pepsi. They want to know how their specific brand and this type of can, let's say, is selling in Illinois for this specific demographic. So we have the data. We own a lot of that data and also the platform for them to run reports on the fly and be able to access that type of information so they can allocate their funds however they want to. So.
Wow. Okay. This is totally, you know, we'll talk about this later, but I read a crazy book that's all about this called Why We Buy, about how they completely, how the people, they like put cameras up and they watch when customers walk up to a shelf and they see a kid grab something at 3 foot and not 5 foot. So like the kid who grabs the candy off the bottom shelf, they're not selling candy at the 5 foot level. So they like realize that. And all they do is that just from watching or getting the data, they're like, oh, well, we'll put candy at the 3 foot shelf and then he's going to toss it in his mom's cart and 3 out of 5 moms will leave it there and 2 moms will throw it on a shelf somewhere else. Yeah. And like, and so all they do is just crunch the numbers and then give it and then sell it back to the companies. Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. So you do my, you do the book I loved. That's interesting. that whole like studying people's, actions is incredibly interesting.
It's a psychological study more than anything.
And it has to be. I mean, at that point, because you walk into a store and like the way those are set up, when I used to work at JCPenney and they set them up very specifically, like colors, certain colors register with your head, certain things register, like this, the down to the music they play, down to the temperature in the building, down to the way they've designed the layout of the building. That's, yeah, that's incredible. Well, that's cool. That's awesome. So let's get back to Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
What, and I, currently, what is, do you know anything that's happening? Like what can I don't know, I don't want to just be like, so tell me about Venezuela now. Like vaguely, all I know is that there was an election. There is a president who got voted out, but isn't leaving. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah.
So what, like, and you know, most of your family's gone, at least your immediate family's gone. You have extended relatives. Have you talked to them about it? What's like the overall feeling for average, you know, capital living people?
Over there, you mean?
Yeah.
So, we have a temporary president right now that he's basically working through the constitution, like trying to use basically our laws to gain enough support from the international countries to help us, like, change our government, basically, change our situation, and really make this more of a permanent change and have elections. The reason why we haven't like had elections again and people vote is because we don't have enough of the support system right now. So like if we were to have elections right now, the structure that's formed around the government is still illegitimate. It's still supportive of this dictatorship that's built over the years. So does it make sense, like, if you really think about it, like if you want to call for fair elections, you have to do a cleanup, you have to put people in that state that will actually allow for fair elections.
Yeah, like a separate third party to come in and be like, we're gonna go out and hold the elections, we'll let you know what the results are, and then if you take them, you take them. If you don't, you don't. At that point, you just got to hope they respect the vote, right?
Right, exactly. And so with that, I mean, in this is a topic of discussion pretty much every day. We have, I have like a family chat through WhatsApp, and I see the conversations on a daily basis on what's changing, what's new in the news, and, it's a very complex process, so it doesn't happen overnight, unfortunately. A lot of us believe that we're close to getting back to a democracy, but it takes a lot of effort and people are still back home fighting for that. So, you know, being here, it's, you know, and people handle it in different ways and I respect everybody's views or everybody's actions on how to best deal with it. For me specifically, getting too close is not healthy. And I've experienced before like extreme stress levels where to a point I couldn't even breathe because I'm too close to it. And I don't know how to keep a, a balance. So
sure.
I'm either far removed from it or very closely in touch with it to the point that I've become too emotional and it affects my health. So today, for instance, for me to stay informed, this is going to sound funny. I message one of my best friends every now and then. I'm like, give me the summary of what's going on.
Please just give me the happy version of it, because you're there and I love you and I need you to be safe, but also.
Yeah.
Exactly. And do they give you the whole, how long is that message? Is it like all of, like, it's just like a mile long text through the.
It could be like that, but no, thank God she gives me more of the high level view.
Okay,
she knows how I am too, and that I can't get into like the weeds of things. So she always gives me a really good summary of like, here's what's going on, and you know, the next move is this, and we're waiting for that decision to take place and whatnot. And it's usually, she sends me like a 5-minute voice note, like on a weekly basis. And I'm like, okay, I'm up to speed. Here we go.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Do you save those?
I do.
Man, I wish I knew that beforehand. We could compile them and play them.
Oh my!
We could have played them for the last 20 minutes of the show.
Well, they'd be in Spanish, so.
Well, we have Spanish listeners.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's true.
Wouldn't know what
I could
saying.
Translate, right? Yeah.
You could, or I mean, we could just play them one day. I mean, if I don't have a guest, could you send them to me? Just be like, please, all Spanish. We'll talk about that later. We'll set the logistics. I do too much forgetting that I am live on the air, so we will handle that at another time. That's awesome. What a good friend.
Yeah.
I don't want to say I don't have a friend like that. I probably could had I poked around and asked for it, but that's cool that you can kind of get the broke down version of it. That kind of helps you stay not, I mean, cause how many, you have all these cousins and aunts and uncles and stuff that all live there. So, I mean, yeah. So they're all, do you think they plan on leaving? I mean, if they're like the elderly are probably going to stay, you know, what's the plan? What is their plan?
Yeah. It's a good question. I mean, I have, within the same family, I have, two different, totally different perspectives. Ones that are looking to still move, they're just waiting for the right time. And others that they have the option to move, but they won't. They won't leave because of attachments to what it's like to live back home. And as I mentioned earlier, it's a great culture. It's a beautiful culture. And, you know, being comfortable with friends and family there is what you're used to, you know? Starting off life from scratch, especially when you're older, it's got to be extremely hard, probably harder than what I did. And so I do have the two different perspectives within my family between like staying or leaving. But I think most, if I really look at my friends, most of them are gone. And that's a typical situation for a Venezuelan, is to have people spread out across the world, all over Europe, all over South America or the U.S. And it's not uncommon to have friends everywhere. And people go like, oh my God, that's so cool. Like you can just go visit and stay with all of them. And I'm like, yeah, but it would have also been nice not having to leave at all, right?
Sure. So, it would have been cool for everyone to be happy at their house and,
yeah,
and get to stay and not have to feel like they need to move to London or whatever. You know what I mean? Like they have that push to leave. I moved because I wanted to.
Exactly.
You moved because you wanted to. I mean, it wasn't getting any better, but you wanted to. I mean, like the thing where like, I have to leave. That's like, and that kind of brings us towards like what's happening now. So you were a kid when Chavez came and took over.
Yeah, 12. Like
12, right. So you saw what you understood to be like a free life, and then saw it turn into what it was for the past 20 years or 25 years. Now as you come to the US and you see I don't want to speak lightly of what's happening in the South America, but like you see like Trump and stuff come and start like preaching this rhetoric where he's playing to the common man's like tone, you know, where he's like trying to feed into that and gain support from people who need help. You know, these, I mean, poor people in the US, and they're doing the exact same thing. What does that do to you? Like when you're sitting here being like, I lived this already. What do you do? Like what? That's not even a good question. What are your thoughts on it? When you saw Trump start coming up and then he won, what was that feeling like for you?
Honestly, it's a little bit scary for sure. And I'm not supportive of his decisions at all whatsoever. But for me, because the problems back home are so much greater, in my perspective, I pay very little attention to what Trump is doing. I almost see him like a buffoon.
Sure. No, absolutely. And I'm trying my best to word this as not, to anyone listening, to not minimalize what the, yeah, the what's happening on an international level. But it's yeah, I mean, as a person who just had to go through it, like watching, like I grew up, I was like, oh, there's just regular democracy and there's no way that a president would stay past his terms. And like, there's no way that they're going to do all this. And all they're now, like, these policies are coming in and they're like, so you see like the anti-immigrant rhetoric. Have you felt anything in the U.S. since you, or in Chicago alone? Chicago is tough because it's a very liberal bubble. But like, have you felt yourself like the negative tone towards immigrants? Has that affected you at all?
So yeah, I've definitely felt it. Not as much in Chicago. When you're in the big cities, it's not that big. I know there's a lot of racism out there for sure.
Sure.
You know, from a cultural perspective, and there's this sense that from a lot of people that we're here to like steal jobs. I mean, that's not a joke. People really truly believe that. And what's interesting to me is that, you know, Americans would take that as a threat because where how I grew up, you basically learn have this concept of survival, and that your values are based around that you have to try your hardest no matter what you do to do the best you can, to evolve continuously, to always learn and then keep up or do better. So my friends, my family, we all have this sense of, you know, trying to, let's call it, survive or persevere, and in many instances of our lives. So then it makes me think of like, why are Americans feeling so threatened by this idea instead of thinking, you know, why are the jobs going away sometimes for, you know, to immigrants, right?
Yeah.
Should we be doing better? Should we be improving our education systems? Should we be trying harder, right? And maybe this is a little bit off topic, but I do see that in kids today that they're celebrating everyone, no matter, like, even the people that haven't put any effort into things, even people. So this concept, for some reason, there's this negative connotation to saying like, oh, you're winning, like there's a team here that's winning, or there's somebody here that is you know, like it receives a medal, for instance, or an award. So they don't want to like all of a sudden make other kids feel bad. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. Like they're eroding the level of like healthy competition that pushes you to be a little bit better.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is so against everything that I was taught as a kid, and that I still truly believe that is significant. And that's important to instill in kids today. Everything, of course, in moderation, but I think of how that impacts who you become as an adult, and whether you strive for success or whether you live a mediocre life. It's totally up to you.
Yeah.
And in America, that mediocre range is so comfortable. And that's the thing. That's a key thing, too. When you go to Venezuela and these other third world countries, there's no space for that. You either survive and do your best to succeed, or you don't, and you're poor and you're hungry and you can't provide for your family. That middle range, it becomes thinner and thinner and thinner. So there's no way of being comfortable and having an okay lifestyle if you don't put the hardest effort you can.
Yeah.
Here, you could be very comfortable living, you know, just a, you know, minimum wage job, and, you know, not necessarily having the best condo, for instance, or the best lifestyle, but you can be okay and then live paycheck to paycheck, and, you know, not really need for more.
Mm-hmm.
So I think because of that too, there's a lot more people that grow up with the idea that, you know, they just want to like reach for further.
Sure.
And that's, I think it applies to any industry, as in the corporate world where I'm at, or even as an artist. Like, why wouldn't you try your best to, you know, develop the most beautiful artwork that you've ever done, or to continuously learn, right?
Yeah.
Why would you ever be comfortable staying where you are today and not evolve? That to me is like what stems, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing in a lot of people today that is stemming from the education system too. And yeah, I know this is totally off topic.
Hey, we got time. This is all, whatever you want to get off your chest about this is your perspective coming from somewhere else is what this show's about. It is not about like Trump bashing. It's not about like immigrants are the best, Americans are the worst. Like it is about what you lived and what you see the U.S. as. That's what this is all about. So no, I totally agree with the whole first chunk here and carry on. So the education system
we could definitely be doing better. And what I love about being here is that there's so many resources, great resources available to kids and even in college as an adult. Like, there's so many positive things that you can do. And I think it's a little bit kind of like how we were talking before, like I underestimated the weather and, you know, the environment that I lived in back home because I took it for granted.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people here take for granted the resource availability that you have at your own hands to fully take advantage of all of those things to become your very best.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's I agree. And I feel like, and so do you think that's kind of like what, and as I watch the news, because I try to do my best to see both sides of the news, like to get both, because at this point it's so polarized. The left and the right at this point are just shouting at each other in completely opposite directions, not really conversing to like figure out why they're different, but just that they're different and then yelling till their head hurts. But I genuinely believe that it probably has to stem from like the internet and the ability to have everyone just thinks they have an opinion. Look at me. I made a podcast up. I made up a show. I happen to get on the radio. Up until this point, I was a podcast. I could make up a show and say anything I want because I have the ability. Like, the technology at this point has allowed everyone to have a voice. And some people shouldn't, right? And then people who don't deserve it are getting more popular, like these like YouTube stars and like these Instagram influencers. That's a real thing where like you're just hot enough to tell people what to buy. It's crazy, right? So you see that stuff and I just don't know what the limit is. You know what I mean? And I hope we get to it soon where we're just like, okay, we've really softened up enough now that like there should be some amount of competition to make sure that we still stay competitive. Even the like some billionaires came out this past week, like Warren Buffett is like the big one everyone talks about, but like a couple of these other guys got together and they were like, we need to tax the rich harder. I mean, these guys have more money than God. Like they don't even, and put it back into the education system because we're failing, especially like urban communities and stuff where brilliant minds are being wasted without the right education systems and source and resources and stuff. Even in Chicago, South Side, parts of the North Side, West Side. I mean, we're shortchanging those people, unfortunately, and they see that and are trying to adjust it a little bit. But who knows? That was one article I read about some guys who said it to a room. You know what I mean? Who knows if that actually turns into legislation? Who knows if they ever actually do any of that? So, yeah, I guess I'm on the same page and just hoping that it ends up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully we can all just kind of strive for better, I suppose.
Yeah. And I agree with you that the impact that social media has in our generation is scary. It's not something to play around with, especially with kids. I see sometimes kids with smartphones, and I'm like, do you know as a parent what you're giving out to your kid? I mean, I think in order for you to be smart about this, you have to be educated. You have to like fully understand, you know, how to take this and not let social media control you.
Sure.
Like, otherwise, it could be a very abusive. So you have to be careful. Like, even I think about this every day as an adult, like how am I using social media? Is it for education purposes, or is it that I'm feeding garbage to my brain?
Yeah.
So there's a fine line, and there's some points where I'm like, you know, I'm going to put this away. I'm not going to look at my phone at all for the next day or so because I can feel it. I can feel suddenly like this need, like, oh, I need to check this. Do you really have to check that? No.
No. I checked Facebook like 8 times on the bus down here.
Yeah.
Why? Because I put up one status and I hope a bunch of people liked it.
Yeah.
And it's like, You know, and like, but for the sake of the show, I wanted to do well. But like, the show ended up being great, whether 1,000 people saw that post and were like, "This is great, I'm going to tune in," or if one person liked it and that was the end of it. Like, but at the same time, yeah, my mind's just geared that way, and it is. It's a focus of it. I find myself doing it at work. I'm less productive. I'm less productive at work. I'm less like, yeah. I mean, and then you see all this stuff and comparing yourself to all these other people. Yeah. So, and it's like, it's, yeah. I mean, it's tough not to. And I find my neck hurts. I'm looking down at my phone so much, my neck hurts.
Yeah.
That's how crazy it's gotten.
And that's the thing, like, and for, to your point, in what you're doing, you know that what you're sharing to the world is something so positive. So it could become a little bit more conflictive too, because you want it to reach to more people, right?
Right.
Because it's, you know, it's a positive message. I completely agree. What I have to say to that, because I've been thinking about that too lately, and in how to, I've been trying to express myself more in social media, which I've never done, to basically showcase this is what I believe in. And it used to be just very hidden. And now I just want to share my thoughts and see what kind of network builds around me because of that, right? And I've been thinking about that, like, should I worry about who's listening, who's reading and whatnot? And then I thought, if I place my focus on that, then I'm not spending more of my time in educating myself further and having more insightful discussions with people like what you and I are doing now.
Yeah.
If I can't put myself in the present, then how am I gonna become better, a better version of what I am today? Going back to what we were just talking about, how can I provide new ideas now and new learning experience that I can share if my focus is on, you know, comparing myself with the other one?
Yeah, everything on social media is the past. It's literally everything that just happened 5 minutes ago.
Exactly. And at the same time, it's like the deepest revelations in my life, or in, you know, those deeper reflections I've had have come not from looking at someone else and comparing myself to another person, have come from spending some time alone, maybe around nature, and really thinking through, you know, this idea, you know, this is how things connect in my brain. And that becomes unique. That magic starts there when you actually disconnect. And then you create these thoughts in your head that could really make a much more deeper impact into somebody else around you. And I think that's the process we need to get used to more, and then share that in social media, but not necessarily like let it control you.
Look at you. You didn't even need the mushroom tea. You came to that all on your own.
There you go.
You didn't even need psychedelics to come to what I would have assumed was a mushroom thought. That's right. Once again, Mom, not that I know anything about that. I have just been looking at Wikipedia. This has been great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I cannot thank you enough. It's been one of my favorite conversations. Is there anything you're working on now that while we have some listeners that you want to plug? Is there anything that you've been doing lately, or like anything you want to share?
Sure. Yeah. So for the past 6 months, I've been involving myself and retreats and deepening my knowledge in yoga. I'm actually doing a yoga training right now.
Nice.
And I guess I want to share that just because these things have created such a positive impact in my life. A lot of the people that I'm surrounded by now are people that push me to strive for success, for becoming better. And we're all very honest to each other about like our personal problems. So it has become a very nice support environment. And yeah, I encourage like anybody listening to find your community, your people that you can have those deep discussions with. A lot of times we spend way too much time with casual relationships that really don't contribute to your growth. You know, it's just, what do you get from that long term? If you really think about, like, does that contribute to what your goals are 10 years from now, or does it not? And so I've gone through a process of really eliminating people like that, people that are just casual relationships in my life, or that would negatively impact, you know, my time, I guess. And then instead focus on spending it more with people that will really help me, and that I know I can help them. And it has drastically changed my focus. you know, just as an example, for instance, like enrolled right now in like a book club from one of the coaches from these retreats that I've been going to, and we're reading, I don't know if anybody's read it, you know, David Goggins.
No.
Oh my God. He's amazing. He's an ex-Navy SEAL, and he has a book called Can't Hurt Me.
Okay.
He's the toughest guy you'll see out there. I can't imagine anybody tougher than him. And you can just look up his Instagram account. He actually had a podcast with Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan interviewed him, and David Goggins is just one tough dude, and you just realize whatever you're going through is not that big enough, and you can definitely get through it.
That's awesome.
He has tough skin. But yeah, that's just one of the things that I'm actually working on right now, and we meet on a monthly basis for the book club. We review it together, share our ideas, and it's just such a positive environment. I keep thinking, these are the people that I need to surround myself with more and more. Why can't this be my environment all the time, you know?
Man, yeah, that would be the dream. That's the dream, to be constantly. Yeah, I feel like that's a lot of people. After I left school, it's the same way, where it's like, you feel like you stop learning. I feel like I started watching documentaries, like try to like pretend I'm still learning. Like that idea of like, no, I'm bettering myself. I promise I am. No, that's awesome. I will look into that book. And what was the name of that book again?
Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins.
Awesome. Yeah, I will definitely look into that. That was great. So that kind of wraps it up. I mean, we got everything out. We got about 2.5 minutes left. Is there any advice for anyone involving the immigration system that you could give in a brief minute and a half, now that I've talked about the minute and a half?
Mm-hmm. I would just say, you know, it's a difficult thing to do, but you know, if that's really what you want, don't give up right away. There were many times in my first 6 months here where I would just cry on a weekly basis. But those are just temporary feelings. Really get past that, and then think through how you can immerse yourself in your environment, how you can adapt, and just don't give up that easily. If what you want is really to be happy in another country and in another cultural environment, then just know it is going to be difficult. You're going to get through it, and try to surround yourself with very positive people that will help you in that adaptation phase.
That is awesome. Thank you again. This is Graciela. And if you've been listening and you've been wondering, you came in halfway through the show and you have no idea what's going on, this is Broken English. It's called Firsthand Immigration Stories. This is a weekly show every week at 6 p.m. to 7:44. And I interview a new immigrant every week and get their story of coming here and what it was like to adapt and their lifestyle and what it took, overcoming the odds and such. If you like the show, please go follow us on social media, even though we just talked smack about it for about 10 minutes. It's the best. The more you can share this, the more people can hear it, the more information we can spread, because I feel like everyone needs to hear at least a couple of these stories. It's been incredibly eye-opening for me as a host to be able to hear all this. So please, brokenenglishpodcast@gmail.com. If you are an immigrant and you would like to be on the show, please contact me. You can hit me up on Twitter or on Facebook or any of that good stuff. Please find the website, brokenenglishpodcast.com, and we can set something up. This has been great. Thanks for listening.